Well, there is no accompanying reading for this evening's lecture. So with that, I will pass the stage over to Sean with his topic, There Is No Planet B.
Well, thanks, Paul. The otherworldly extra voice is coming from my laptop here, so we'll just turn that down. Well, good evening, everyone. And thanks for taking time out to come and join us here tonight, and certainly for those online. And I want to start by showing you a photograph. Anybody know what this is a picture of? Somebody's got an answer. That's the moon. Stephen at the back. No, incorrect. One of the first times I've said that to Stephen. This is actually the very first picture that was taken from space of planet Earth. It was actually taken in 1966 on August 23rd from the unmanned Lunar Orbiter 1. And it's very low resolution because, and this is for the photographers in the audience, the primary instrument on the spacecraft was a 150-pound Eastman Kodak imaging system that could develop exposed film, then scan the image, and then send them almost like a fax back to the Earth. And that's why you see this image. Taken from Apollo 8, Christmas Eve, 1968. And so what happened is astronaut Bill Anders was in the Apollo 8 spacecraft. They were rounding the dark side of the moon for the fourth time. As the Earth came up over the horizon, Anders scrabbled this time for his Hasselblad camera and started clicking away and took a number of photographs. Astronaut Jim Lovell, one of the pilots who was on the board that day, James Lovell and William Anders, who comprise the crew, it's back again. So whatever you did before, just... So moving back a few minutes, interestingly, the three pilots that were on board Apollo 8, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and Bill Anders, all identified as Christians back in 1968. And actually, during the Apollo 8 mission, they famously read from the book of Genesis in the Bible during a live television broadcast on Christmas Eve in 1968. And they had a message of goodwill, and they had reflections on the beauty of the Earth from space, and that in the time resonated with many people around the world. I guess you'd say, my, how times have changed. Well, maybe they thought of this quote from the book of Job, written at least 2,500 years or so ago, long before the Earth was ever seen from another perspective except standing on it. The book of Job states, he stretches out the north over the empty place and hangs the earth on nothing. And this was the words of Job himself speaking about the God that he knew. And there it is, hanging out there upon nothing. But it was not created for nothing. It was not created for no reason. In fact, the earth was created for a purpose. Here's another wonderful quote, and I suppose you could say, thinking about what Jim Lovell said about the fragility and the beauty and the insignificance that we might feel in the face of this amazing planet, as grand as that was, seeing that planet hanging out there in the darkness, there was all the time, and even before the dawn of the creation of man, a purpose that was sweeping over the face of that blue marble. That makes sense of the vastness and the blackness. Over 2,800 years ago, the Jewish prophet Isaiah, whose very name means salvation of the Lord, wrote this statement. For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens. He is God, who formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it empty. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. And so for myself as a Christian, and for those who believe that this planet was created for a special purpose, and that purpose is that God intended it to be inhabited by us, by you and me. I want to show you another photograph. As I hesitantly plug back in my state-of-the-art technology. Anybody know what this is a picture of? It's not the moon, but good question, good answer. This is a picture of Mars. Mars is over 300 million kilometers away. It's a picture actually taken, a reflective picture behind the Curiosity rover, looking back at its tracks. It's traveled the Curiosity rover now about 28 kilometers, which doesn't sound like a lot, but the Curiosity rover is about 10 feet long. It's actually quite large, and it moves really, really slow, and it's doing testing and experiments as it goes. And, you know, for me growing up, because I was, you know, used to read a lot of comic books, Mars was a kind of a space, a place of science fiction. Now people are actually talking about going there. Anybody know what it's actually like on the surface of Mars? And I'm not speaking from experience here. Well, I'll tell you a few things. First of all, the solar radiation is over 50 times the average on Earth, which of course over a very short period of time would cause cancer, sickness, death within probably a number of months. But before the radiation got to you, you would freeze to death because the temperature in the nighttime can drop as low as minus 140 degrees Celsius. But as fast as the freezing would be, you would asphyxiate even quicker because Mars only has 1% of the oxygen that we need. And what little air there is primarily carbon dioxide, which would immediately suffocate you. Oh, and by the way, there's no water. And this is where Elon Musk wants to send us. The question is, when you think about it, do you really want to live on Mars? And actually, that begs, I think, another question, which is, why go to Mars in the first place? Well, if you ask NASA and SpaceX and the European Space Agency and all the others, plus you talk to Mars nerds for, you know, there's lots of different reasons why you would go to Mars. Well, here's just a few of them. Number one, well, we'd understand more about our origins, they say. We would grow as a species because it's about developing technologies and it's about exploration. Some say we'd be developing political and economic leadership. It's almost like, you know, the first to the moon, now the first to Mars, so that you could exploit it, which is, again, about discovering more resources because, let's face it, ours here are starting to get used up. But the number one reason that all these experts want to go to Mars is to ensure the survival of humanity. That sounds like we're facing existential risk on this planet. Like this planet that we are on is running out of time. Planet A, I guess you could call it. And I guess that's where our topic becomes a very poignant statement because as far as I'm concerned, there is no planet B. We're on this earth and this is all we have. Mars is actually the worst of the worst options of what we could do to resolve the issues that are here on earth. This is planet A. There is no planet B. And interestingly, this topic has caused a little bit of controversy here over the past week as many of you have got it wrong. Some came up and said, Sean, is your topic, there's no plan B? I said, no, that's a completely different subject altogether. Others have said, well, hey, where did you get the topic? It's a great topic. Well, it's not, I didn't make this up. In fact, it's become a very common phrase in society. You may have seen it, for example, I don't know, on a bumper sticker or on TV at a protest. Maybe you saw a banner unfurled over an overpass or, you know, the number of memes that are flowing around like this one from Greta Thunberg. Or if you're listening to the UN a couple of years ago, French President Macron. Kind of loses its impact. But this particular phrase is actually attributed to this author, Mike Berners-Lee, who wrote this book back in 2019. The book is entitled There Is No Planet B. And he says a lot of things in his book. He tackles climate change and achieving sustainability. And you know, he talks about there needing to be this collective effort from all entities, individuals, governments, businesses, organizations all around the world in order to attempt to tackle this issue of climate change. And the trick, of course, is getting all these entities to actually work together. In fact, it has been an impossible task. And if you want to know how it's working out, let's just ask the Secretary General of the United Nations himself.
The jury has reached the verdict and it is damning. This report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a litany of broken climate promises. It is a file of shame, cataloging the empty pledges that put us firmly on track towards an unlivable world. We are on a fast track to climate disaster. This is a climate emergency. Climate scientists warn that we are already perilously close to tipping points that could lead to cascading and irreversible climate impacts.
You know, we all know what climate change is. And all around the globe, including our government here in Canada, we're all saying that we're going to change. We're going to change the way we do business. We're going to change the way we use energy. We're going to change the way that we deal with waste. We're going to change the way we output our emissions. But the sad thing is, and this is not the first time he said this or experts have said this, nothing is actually changing. In fact, it's actually getting worse. And as the UN Secretary General says, these are all empty promises. Interesting quote from this gentleman here, Robert Swan. He's a polar explorer and he's an author, and he says something I think we would probably all agree with. The greatest threat to our planet is the belief that someone else will save it. And that's not only a problem for those of us individually. It's like, well, you know, I may not be doing my part, but my neighbor certainly is recycling. But that happens on a national and on a global scale. None of us are doing our part because we think someone else will do it for us. And so if you look at, you know, these markers, these climate signals that are constantly being talked about in the press and in research and amongst governments, what do they tell us about the planet? Well, these major markers, at least, you know, these ones here, we're just going to deal with four. There's probably 10 or so markers that are tracked, you know, almost to the minute. These four here have been actually tracked for over 50 years. Some of them, they go back to the late 1800s. Sea level rise, the number of natural disasters that are occurring and the size and the effect of them, CO2 emissions is another one, and of course, the rising temperature on this planet. And if you look at all these particular, and I love graphs, by the way, you look at all these particular graphs, they're all going up. Sea level is up 9 inches since 1880 and a couple of inches just in the last 25 years. Natural disasters are up 30% just in the last 40 years, and that's all forms of natural disasters, and we won't cover all of those, but they're listed up there. CO2 emissions, they say, are up a staggering 350,000% since the turn of the century, and up 30% just in the last 10 years. And temperature increase, we use a local example from the Gonzales weather station in Victoria here, from 1899 until 2015, the average mean temperature in Victoria has risen steadily from just over 9.5 degrees to just over 11 degrees. And I think we would all agree it's hotter here in Victoria than it literally ever has been. I remember when Marty and I were first married, we bought a Jeep, and you know, she would almost never drive with the roof off because it was just too cold. Well, now, you know, to get a 30 degree plus summer day is actually very common. And so, as it goes with all of these markers, so it goes with the planet. And unlike a sales chart, these charts are all bad. Now, here's something that Mike would know a little bit about. The example of wildfires that we have right now happening in this province and almost right across Canada, very oddly, out in Nova Scotia, they've been having wildfires. So the question is, are forest fires, are wildfires getting worse in Canada? Well, in terms of the number of fires goes up and down every year, every decade, and they're kind of maybe a little bit less right now. However, the scale of the fires and the intensity of the fires is almost off the chart. That's mainly because as it gets hotter and drier, the natural protection in the forest is just disintegrating. Now, here's a fire weather index from across Canada from last year, June of 2022. And you can imagine from the legend there that anything that's blue is good, right? It's cool or it's moist and there isn't a high probability of there being a fire. And of course, everything that's, you know, orange and red is problematic. In fact, the areas that are red are either on fire or predicted to be on fire. So this is last year. Well, this is this year as of a couple of days ago. Literally 60% of the country is in a danger or extreme danger of forest fires. Do you know that already in 2022, as of just a couple of days ago, more than 10 million acres of forest has been burnt in Canada? So bad it is right now that I was watching some news articles from Washington, D.C., from the east coast of the United States, which is orange because they've got all the smoke coming across from B.C. and Alberta and other areas in Canada, and the smoke is making its way across the Atlantic, and it's over in Europe. Human-caused climate change has exacerbated what is already problematic conditions, hot and dry conditions, that are allowing these wildfires to ignite and to grow. I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't already know. The point is we're trying to, you know, set a purpose to this talk and try to gain some understanding about where this is going. And so to insert some more biblical text from the prophet Isaiah, who spoke about 800 years before the birth of Christ, says in chapter 24, starting at verse 19, he prophesies about the end times. The earth is utterly broken. The earth is split apart. The earth is violently shaken. The earth staggers like a drunken man. It sways like a hut. Its transgressions lie heavy upon it, and it falls and will not rise again. And you know, oftentimes when, you know, Christian groups quote verses like this in the face of calamity, it makes you look like you're some sandwich board wearing, you know, end times prophet walking the street saying the end is near. Well, you know, I believe the Bible is true, and I believe all of these verses, certainly the ones specific to the end times, are telling us that the time of the age of man is drawing to a close. And the time of the age of God is quickly to be upon us. There is great distress on this earth. We can literally see it before our eyes. So the question then is, well, what options do we have? And if you read expert articles, the first thing they say is, well, we have to stop all harmful human activity. Okay, well, the question is this possible? Is it even possible to stop even some harmful human activity? Well, I would say that what I can see going on in the world, it's not possible. The world is dependent on the things that we do. It's dependent on the way we do them. And at least for the next 50 years, even in developed countries, our need to use resources in the way we're currently using them will not change. Not to mention the even greater demand that is happening in developing countries. Here's just a few quotes so we can understand what we're talking about. Here's Naomi Klein. I've actually quoted her before. She's a Canadian author, political activist. She's a filmmaker, has some documentary films under her belt. She's written a number of books on climate change, and the politics surrounding climate change is really what her focus is. And look at what she says. Our economy is at war with many forms of life on Earth, including human life. What the climate needs to avoid collapse is a contraction in humanity's use of resources. Really, it should say, but what our economic model needs to avoid collapse is unfettered expansion. Simply put, there's a conflict. Actually, it's a diabolical conflict between the human need to grow and expand and the Earth's capacity to sustain it. It's just completely incompatible. And that's one of the reasons why we have the problems that we have. The earth is giving us signals, very strong signals, that it cannot cope with the way that we are using it. It doesn't matter whether you think that climate change is human caused or naturally caused or naturally caused and humanly exacerbated. It doesn't matter. The fact remains the climate is changing. Now let's look at another graph. I love this graph. This is from an article from the New Scientist back in 2008. This report was published where they show how across the globe, the use of virtually everything is going up, which means it's getting worse. Now, I mean, every measure by which we abuse the planet is getting worse. Just, for example, driving cars. There's more cars being sold. There's more cars being driven. Air travel. There's more air travel happening. the exploitation of fisheries, the use of water, the use of paper, the extinction of species, everything that we would look, even to the minutest level that we are doing on the earth, is getting worse. Now listen to this quote from the Guardian newspaper writing about this scientific journal entry from The New Scientist. Quote, "Unlike other animal species who focus on their survival in times of distress, when faced with an impending or chronic threat such as climate or ecological breakdown, we humans seem to go out of our way to compromise our survival. We convince ourselves it's just not so serious, or even that it maybe isn't even happening. And then we double down on destruction, swapping our ordinary cars for huge SUVs, jetting into oblivion on long-haul flights, burning it all up in a final frenzy." It's as if to say, this quote goes on, in the back of our minds, there's this voice whispering, if it were really so serious, somebody would stop us. If we attend to these issues at all, we do so in ways that are petty, tokenistic, comically ill-matched to the scale of our predicament. And the quote closes by saying, it is impossible to discern in our response to what we know the primacy of our instinct to survive. It's like we know what's happening, but we just don't care. And if we just don't care, we absolutely do not know how to fix it. Reminds me of this quote from the book of Jeremiah. I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself. That is not in man who walks to direct his steps. And so really what the prophet is saying is sadly we cannot manage this thing ourselves. We've been given stewardship of the earth and we have completely forsaken our duties. You know, there's this mock conversation that somebody had recently with somebody else about climate change. And it goes something like this. Talking about what a horrible thing we are doing to the earth, the one person said, "Did you have coffee this morning?" "Yes," is the answer. "Well, did you grow that coffee bean in your backyard and roast it with the heat of the sun and grind it on a stone grinder turned by hand and press that through a filter made out of moss?" "No," they respond. Interesting thing, even when we drink coffee, we require ships to bring it from afar, gas to roast it, electricity to grind it, paper filters made out of trees cut down with chainsaws and driven to the mill in huge trucks so that we can sip a delightful cup of Colombian coffee. This statement is made to sort of underscore that even in the very smallest things in our life, like drinking coffee, our lifestyle is totally unsustainable. In fact, none of our lifestyle is really sustainable. Almost everything we use in our daily lives comes from some form of naturally occurring resource, chopped down, ground up, dug up, burned, melted, smelted, purified, refined, manufactured in some way. You know, if we had just got it right, I suppose, in the Garden of Eden, I don't think any of this would have been a problem. But sadly, like Adam and Eve did, so we are all reaching for more things, for better things, for bigger things, for greater things, for selfish things. It's actually not the way that God intended. So stopping all forms of harmful human activity is probably not going to happen either. What other options do we have? Well, we could invent benign technology. If we can't stop destroying things, then perhaps we could invent and use technologies that would help us not be harmful to the environment. Now, I don't really know anything at scale that fits this particular bill. You've heard, I'm sure, about the huge Atlantic gyre. I'm not even sure whether you pronounce that gyre or gyrie. It's the massive island larger than the size of the state of Texas that is floating out in the ocean made out of a pile of plastic waste and garbage. Now, why hasn't the United Nations built a ship with a huge mouth on it that just eats it all up and resolves that particular problem? Well, as someone once said, it's really cool and exciting to put dune buggies on Mars, but not so exciting to clean up the ocean. Because it's not about money, it's about motivation. Man is very ingenious. We do have the political will to invest where we want to and where there's money to be made, but where there's no money to be made, sadly, we do not invest. Well, let's look at some of these benign technologies. And I apologize right out of the gate for anyone here who probably does have some or all of these things in your possession. I'm just trying to generalize. But first, here's a guy that looks like he knows what he's talking about. He's got a PhD in atmospheric science. He's also an engineer and has made and invented many things. And he says, John R. Christie, says, from my analysis, the actions being considered to stop global warming will have an imperceptible impact on whatever the climate will do, while making energy more expensive and thus have a negative impact on the economy as a whole. And so this is a very real problem, is that any of these technologies that they look at are problematic on a major scale with the economic model. Well, I'm going to look at three very common benign, so-called benign technologies, and just show you a little bit of the dark side. And helping me along here is an article by the Harvard Business Review, so it must be true, that was written in 2021. Now, researchers looked into the impact of three different renewable energy technologies. And we're going to look at all three of them. Solar panels, wind farms, and EV vehicles. So take solar energy and solar panels. And I was almost in the industry about 15 or 18 years ago, so I got to see a few interesting things about how solar panels, photovoltaic panels, are made. And it's currently, you know, just so you know, still a very inefficient way to generate power, given the cost to install it and to maintain it. But nonetheless, it's taken off in dramatic ways, mainly in Sunbelt areas in North America, and, you know, maybe more than partly due to Canadian and U.S. government subsidies. There's a very dark side to solar panels. And I saw this initially with the company that I work for, LG Electronics, which was, what do you do with them when they've ended their life? See, these panels only last about 25 years, and they, you know, break down. They're in the sun almost all the time. And also, if they only last about 25 years, there's also new technology coming onto the market all the time that's more efficient, that's better, that will generate more power. So people are disposing of their panels in about 25 years. And they're also now disposing of panels even earlier than that, because they know they can upgrade and get a better quality, more efficient product that's going to generate for them more energy. So there's kind of two problems here. Well, the International Renewable Energy Agency, interestingly, the acronym is IRENA, official projections assert that vast amounts of annual waste are anticipated starting in the early 2030s, because panels were coming on stream roughly 20 years ago. So in about another 5 years, that 25-year lifespan is going to start to end. The initial total waste from solar panels will start at around 78 million tons a year, growing every year. Now, I don't know about you, but 78 million tons is a staggering amount of panels. And where do those panels go? Right now, there is no scale facilities to recycle them. So guess what? They go into landfills. Now, what are solar panels made out of? Well, they're mostly glass, a little bit of silicon. There's aluminum in the framing and in the structure. And there's some base metals, some electronics. But they're very difficult to recycle because of the makeup of the panel. So right now, they're getting buried in landfills. Okay, well, what about wind power? Isn't that working? Okay. Let's first be clear about what windmills we're talking about. Okay, we're not talking about these ones, all right? We're talking about these ones. Now, when Marnie and I lived in Ontario, the then Liberal government, this goes back, you know, 20 years ago, the then Liberal government spent literally billions of dollars installing almost 10,000 of these from roughly Hamilton all the way down to the Windsor border. In fact, when we drove that highway to go down to Detroit, for example, this is literally all you saw in some parts of the province. Windmills as far as the eye could see. Now, there's a lot of documentation about the ill effects of windmills. That's really not what I'm talking about. They create noise. They create a frequency noise. There's the disruption of migratory bird paths. Not to mention, let's be honest, they just look plain awful. But these huge wind turbine blades have to be replaced. They don't last more than 10 years. With all the stress of the inertia, them spinning around as fast as they do, every 10 years or so, the blades and the poles oftentimes and the motors in them have to be scrapped. Now, seeing as some of these blades are over 200 feet long and they are designed to not break apart, and they're made of basically wood and steel and fiberglass, what do you do with them when you replace them? Well, right now, you bury them in the ground. As the picture shows, that's a clip taken from CBS Morning News talking about actually these three technologies. There's no large-scale recycling for these, and they don't feel that there's going to be any large-scale recycling for at least the next 10 to 15 years. Because what do you do with shredded fiberglass? Now, I'm not saying that these technologies don't help the planet. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that these technologies applied to a global scale on the dark side create global problems that have yet to be resolved. Okay, well, I saved this the best to last because you asked maybe, what about electric cars? Won't electric cars save the planet? After all, most of the CO2 comes from transportation. Number one source of emissions from CO2 comes from basically agriculture and farming. And number two is from transportation, cars and trucks driving on highways. Well, let's just look a little bit about this and just to make everybody feel a little bit better, because I know we have a couple here tonight who both have electric cars, and yes, EVs do reduce pollution. Okay, let's just state that. The experts actually say that at a small scale, currently, EVs reduce pollution. And at a small scale, charging your car at home is very manageable. So the issues with EV is not that they don't reduce emissions. The problem with EVs is at scale, how do you power them? So considering in BC, we have a fairly high adoption rate of electric vehicles in BC, a little bit more than 10% of the cars on the road or the cars being sold now are electric. There's not a lot of burden to the grid. Also, BC has a lot of electricity, and we have another hydroelectric dam coming online. So BC is very fortunate in how we're set up. But think about BC or Canada or the United States with 100% of cars electric on the road, and all transport trucks, which use the real power, and trains, and planes, everything that is on the grid now, air conditioners and electric lights and furnaces, and add all of the transportation network, everything onto the grid right now, it is technologically unimaginable. Now, I read a report put together by the National Grid Corp, and we actually have two gentlemen in the room who are electricians, so hopefully you'll like this. The National Grid Corp did a report on electrifying the transport issue industry in the United States. And we don't have to go over everything, but we can later if you gentlemen want to talk about it. It's very, very interesting, I felt. And just here, a quote here. It says, quote, the real challenge is how quickly high-speed chargers will need to deliver electricity at a single place in time. So, and I know Matt and Ryan, I'm dumbing it down, but this is for the rest of the audience. This isn't for the three of us, because we get this. Think about electricity like water flowing through a hose. Okay? I got a thumbs up from Ryan. You could fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool with a garden hose if you had roughly 2 months. But what if you needed to fill that Olympic-sized swimming pool in 2 hours? Well, you would require an absolutely massive fire hose. So in the world of electric vehicles, a car requires a garden hose. But an 18-wheeler, which has a Olympic swimming pool-sized battery, requires massive amounts of energy immediately to charge it up. But listen to this. What this means is that to convert highway gas stations, you know, when we drive down to the U.S. or even across Canada, you go into these massive gas stations and they have 40, you know, petrol pumps and two charging stations, convert those 100% over to electricity. If you were to convert these highway gas stations over to EV charging, the stations for all vehicles, so taking transport charging and cars, so all the transportation that currently fills up with gas, now getting electricity, each gas station would require the amount of power that would power a town of 10,000 people to keep transportation running. For example, the Tesla Semi has a 1,000 kilowatt battery, and currently it takes about 4 hours to charge. Now, that charging rate for the electricians here, that's a megawatt. Now, how much is a megawatt? Well, a megawatt is 1 million watts, or 1,000 kilowatts. That is enough electricity in one Tesla Semi battery. One battery is enough to instantaneously supply electrical demand to 750 houses. You know how many trucks, you know how many transport trucks are on the road in the United States? Hundreds of thousands, driving on average 500 to 1,000 kilometers a day. That's one or two fill-ups every day. So this is the problem. We are not going to do this worldwide without way more windmills, solar panels on every single possible surface, and gigantic hydroelectric dams. And for the countries that have no wind or no flat surfaces or no hydro to create hydroelectric dams, well, I guess they're going to keep burning coal, which is what's happening in developing countries. And we're shipping it out from Swanson terminals. In fact, even as first world countries try to reduce emissions and introduce new technologies, and in some cases, probably more and more cases, force its citizens to lower consumption, countries like India, China, most if not all South American countries, African nations are just coming online, and their consumption is absolutely spiking. Well, that's a lot of bad news. It actually says, again, the prophet Isaiah in chapter 24, the earth lies defiled under its inhabitants. For they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. And I really feel, as draconian as this statement is, that it kind of feels this way. That here we are suffering under all of this, you know, this curse, as it were. I don't think there could be a more fitting quote from this prophet Isaiah, who actually had a lot to say about the future of the earth. And so we only have to look around and read the news and really see how bad the earth is getting. So is there another solution? Well, I'm sure you know where I'm going here. You know, if it's going to be, you know, virtually impossible to stop all harmful human activity, well, I guess the question is, should we do that? Well, of course we should. But this is not going to resolve the issue, at least not in the 12 or so years that experts say we have only left until the climate reaches that point of no return? Should we as humanity look for ways that we can resolve this this issue with benign technology? Well, of course. There are good technologies out there that reduce pollution. For example, we mow our lawns with battery electric lawnmowers because we're doing our part. There are technologies that work, and I'm not saying I don't advocate for them, but the problem is so massive, it is beyond human scale. And that's not me saying that. That's not me quoting Bible verses to say that. That's what the experts are saying. It's virtually beyond human scale, certainly beyond our capability and our desire to scale. And therefore, I believe it only fits God's capability. In fact, I say that we should probably all join the greatest environmental movement in the world, the look to divine power to solve. In fact, we could call this the divine change revolution. Well, here's a couple more verses, because there's a positive side, of course, to all of this. And that is that at the beginning, I quoted the verse that said that God created this earth to be inhabited. So if right now, you know, humanity is destroying it, that means that at some point, God's going to step in and say, that's enough, and start fixing it. And actually, the statement that he makes a couple of times in the Bible, actually three times in the Bible, similar to this in Numbers 14 and 21, where God says, as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. So in the beginning of God's purpose was to create a place where his glory could dwell. And so you might ask yourself, well, what is the glory of God? Well, I think the glory of God manifests in many different ways. The beauty of natural creation. That's the glory of God. People living in peace and harmony and love. That gives glory to God. No more crime, no more sadness, no more sickness, no more disease. That certainly would be glorious to God. Certainly there is a solution coming. The Lord says in Revelation 11 and 8, he says, the time has come to destroy those who destroy the earth. So those who are intent on destroying the earth will meet their judgment, and then God will turn things around. Prophet Isaiah again says, they shall not hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters covered the sea. Again, saying that similar thing to Numbers 14 and 21. This earth is not to be destroyed so that we can fly off to Mars and then destroy that. God's plan is here. The future is here. And it's a much, much brighter future. And there will come a day when people will not hurt. They will not destroy the earth. They will not hurt or destroy each other. They will respect it because they will recognize that God made it. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Prophet Isaiah again says, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. And we can see all the parts of the earth that are ruined by man's greed, restored to beauty. Can you imagine a world that rejoices with singing at the beauty of God's creation? And so, really, what's the final message of this talk tonight? Do we have a looming climate disaster? Well, all signs are pointing to yes. Should we throw up our hands in defeat as Christians? No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is we have to trust in the solution that we know will work. There is a much greater power that is at play here, and God will not let the earth be destroyed. He will bring it back to health. People can march and protest movements all over the world. They can shout out, there's no planet B. But for those that believe here on planet A, the one that God made for us, we can rest assured that God will fulfill his promise. And one thing that I haven't talked about, of course, is what about us? You know, we've talked about the planet. What about you and me? Well, that's actually the best part of it, because the Word of God is very clear about that. God knows our situation. He knows our issues. He knows our trials. He knows our strengths and our weaknesses. And there is a great and hopeful future that God has reserved for us, for those of us that have faith. Now, we've been using the prophet Isaiah all night, so I don't want to stop now. Isaiah 66, I mean, the prophet Isaiah just says beautiful things about the future, and here's one of them. Chapter 66 and verse 1 and 2, the Lord says, "Heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me? And what is the place of my rest? All these things," the Lord says, "all these things my hand has made. And so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look. The one who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word." Those are the people that God is looking for to be part of this grand restoration. And if we want to be part of a world that is beautiful and restored, then I urge you to read the Bible and consider all of the signs that are around us, the signs in nature and the signs that God has divinely inspired to give us through his word. It is God's way. I believe all the things, and we had a talk last week about artificial intelligence. We had a talk a few weeks ago about the decline in population coming soon to this earth. And we have lots of talks from this platform talking about the future that is coming on this earth. But all of the signs that we see prophetically and in the natural world around us is God's way of telling us that his plan is coming to pass. And just remember, there is no planet B.